Hello and welcome into this Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host, with this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity for a midweek version this August 26th of 2020. Beginning our recording right about 8 o'clock a.m. Central Time. And I had one of those tech weirdnesses happen this morning, so I honestly wasn't too sure things were really going to happen today. Because I, for some reason, my computer decided it didn't want to connect to the internet, the one that I use for all of the one computer that controls the other computers that do things, and I have to have it connected online to be able to access audio and things like that from news stories. And I have a couple of audio pieces I want to share with you today, so it was necessary to get that happening. And so, seriously, right up until just a minute before we got going here, I was watching things reboot, which is always nerve-wracking. It's just, you're just counting down. I've got a clock over here. It's counting its way into to 8 a.m., and it's just like, come on. And it all came back together again, finally, just a minute or so before we got rolling. And it just, yeah. And I don't know why. It's just odd. It's been running fine. And, well, who knows? And, of course, I got to be honest with you, though. I may be getting paranoid because I've seen enough weirdness happen lately as far as, you know, Facebook blocking and the like, that it makes me wonder if sometimes somebody could be playing with me. I don't think that's happening because, honestly, I'm really not on the radar. It's not like this is not a Sean Hannity podcast by any stretch. It's not Rush Limbaugh. It's just little old me. But you never know. I mean, Facebook does some weird things. Twitter does some weird things. They're all doing weird things. And here's an example. A friend of mine, Keith, posted something to social media. And along with it, he posted, "Hey, I bet Facebook covers this with some sort of a warning." And sure enough, they did. They covered it with a link. And I said, I thought, well, why don't I share that? And so I did, and I shared it to the Daily Perspective podcast page. And along with it, I noted the Facebook protectors of delicate sensibilities will probably cover this meme with some kind of warning to protect you from politically based humor. Why? Because they think you're too stupid to know it's humor. They also don't understand that all successful humor is based upon reality. You see, the reason something is truly funny is because it plants its feet on the real world. So any good gag is based in something you can really relate to yourself personally, because it takes its cues from reality. Not what we imagine to be real, but things that are real. Really good humor does that. That's why people like Jerry Seinfeld were so successful. His observational humor was based on observing life. And so he would do entire routines based on things that you and I could relate to because, yeah, I've seen that happen. That's hilarious. That's how things work. And really successful comics will do that. The unsuccessful ones will drop the F-bomb from time to time just to shock people, just to get their attention and to get a laugh because it's shocking. Well, really successful comics don't do that. Real humor is based upon reality. I challenge you, go back and look at some of Seinfeld's old routines. They're awesome because he bases them in reality and then launches off into the absurd. And the same goes for other great comics like Brian Regan, who tells stories about his life and then twists them into the realm of the absurd. It's all about reality because you and I can relate. It's the real world. But the protectors of delicate sensibilities over at Facebook and other places don't see the world in the real sense. They see the world through what they think it should be. And because it's never what it should be, they're constantly ticked off. They're angry because life is not what they hope it should be. So, hang on here. Let me see. I'm going to update my post real quick while we're doing this. Okay. So now I've just updated it. So if you've actually seen that on the Facebook page today, that little update happened right now. That's when I did it. Okay. What else? I got sidetracked, and it's really weird, the computer thing, because for some reason I rebooted the other day. I restarted the system, which I do from time to time. I try to do it a couple of times a week. The thing is that I'm using Mac computers here, Apple computers, and generally they just run and they're just as solid as a rock. They're as dependable as they can be. And still, every now and then, if they've been running for a while, and when I say by a while, I mean weeks, because Mac users tend to leave their computers alone because they just don't do anything weird. Every now and then, if there's an update in the middle of the night and the system doesn't reboot like it should, then it will behave oddly. And I think that may have been what happened here, was that I used the Firefox browser for everything because it's quick. And yeah, I know there are a couple of others that are quicker, but Firefox has some features that I like. And I noticed a few days ago that even though I use the Firefox browser, but my default browser in the system settings is Apple's browser, Safari. And when I go through my show notes, and if you're a regular listener and you've used my show notes, you know how this works. I go to my show notes and I click the links that I've accumulated to open the pages to the stories I want to talk about, and it opens Safari because that's the default browser. Well, one day last week, it started opening pages in Firefox as though Firefox was now my default browser, and I never set it that way, and that was odd. But this morning, after rebooting in a panic right before going live, and that reminds me, I need to put up Lady Liberty there. Okay, I noticed that when I clicked on my links now after rebooting, it's using Safari again. Well, who knows? I don't understand. It's just, you know, it's just one of those crazy things. I just don't understand, but sometimes, you know, sometimes these things happen. And I the internet, computers.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, that dang old internet, man, yeah. You just go on there and point and click. Yeah. It's real easy, man.
Yeah, I know. But it's not the internet. It's something local. Anyway, that's weirdness. So how are you? 8.5 minutes into the podcast. How are you? I hope you're doing well. I hope you've had a great day yesterday. I hope you and yours are well. And I hope that that you are seeing life through the proper lens, which is easier this week than it was last week, because the Republican convention is on. And if you've been watching it, as many, many, many more people have online than did the Democrat convention. Oh, I know. They're saying, yeah, the Democrat convention's just crushed the viewership on television. Here's the news. CNBC's viewership for the convention coverage is way up this week over last week. So that is C-SPAN, I should say, C-SPAN. And the reason for that is that conservative people, just the general public, average guys and gals, are sick of all of the interruptions from the news channels. They don't want to watch convention coverage with constant commentary. They want to be able to watch the convention coverage and actually hear what the speakers are saying instead of being interrupted and told what the speakers, oh, this is what they're really saying. They don't want that. They want to see and hear what's actually going on. And so, this week, C-SPAN's viewership has spiked. It's gone crazy because people are going to C-SPAN to watch the convention instead of allowing the news media to interpret the convention for them. Now, the on-air television and news network coverage has dropped a bit. And the leftists are all saying, well, that's a victory for the Democrats. Actually, no, it isn't. It isn't a victory for the Democrats. It's a victory for conservative people who don't like the interpretation being presented to them by the Democratic operatives in the news media. So, kudos to the Republican Party. By the way, I don't know if you've noticed this, if you've been watching, but the production values of the Republican convention are worlds beyond the production values of the Democrat convention. And I was thinking about this earlier this morning, about how much better the video and audio quality has been for the Republican video that we've been watching. And I think that is not because they're throwing a lot of money at it. They are, but that's not why. It's because the Democrats have all bought into the fear, panic, and terror that they've generated, and they want to preserve the fear factor of COVID-19. And so the video they presented all looked like it was recorded on a low budget in locations that were not public, because that's the smart thing to do, is to not go outside, to not congregate with people, to not gather, to not expose yourself to things. And so they have bought into that mentality, to that thinking, and their blinders in that sense had led them to produce video that reflected that particular view. And so what you saw was people in small rooms with cameras. Sometimes the quality was not great. Sometimes the audio or video quality, neither of them were great. But it all reflected the sort of the Zoom meeting mentality that a lot of people have come to accept as the norm for the past several months. You don't see your friends in person. You don't get together for a meal. You don't go grab a pizza together. You don't go shopping together. You don't do these things because of the fear of COVID-19. And so instead of doing that, the way we have personal contact is impersonal. It's through the internet, through the web, using products like Zoom or Facebook Live or using FaceTime on your iPhone or something like that. We're not seeing people together in person. And so we're used to seeing these low-budget video audio productions coming towards us from our friends and to our friends and to our social groups, to our church groups and things like that. We're going to church via Zoom nowadays. Our Sunday schools are via Zoom nowadays. Our midweek gatherings are via Zoom nowadays. And so we're all getting used to that particular look. And when we see what's happening with the Republican convention and the high-quality video, it stands out. And that's because the people producing the Republican convention aren't buying into the fear. They are, in spite of everything that's going on, producing the highest quality product they can. And that alone should tell you a remarkable difference between the two mentalities. One buys into the fear and propagates it. The other acknowledges that there, yes, is a real problem, but doggone it, that's not going to stop us from putting together the best production we can. And that is what we're seeing. And that's just a thought on what we've seen. Now, there are other things we have seen, and I'm going to share some of that stuff with you today. There are, we're going to talk about Melania. I can't share you Melania's audio. It's a half hour. It's 28 minutes and some change. And I honestly haven't had time to dissect it, to pull out pertinent parts. But we'll talk about her speech and the lowlives and what they've had to say about it as well. We'll also talk about a young man who faced a great deal of opposition in the mainstream press and from progressives in general. A young man named Nick Sandman. He spoke to the RNC last night, and what he had to say is important. And I want you to remember this as you listen to it in just a few minutes. Everything he had to say was also broadcast on the news networks he had things to say about. Very interesting. Plus, we'll also look at some other aspects of the convention, and we'll touch on George Floyd, because something has been made public that we need to deal with. And that all begins when the Daily Perspective continues after this break. Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective podcast. A little Blondie there. That's good stuff. Come on.
Color me your color, baby. Color me your car.
Well, we were talking about all things convention, and there were other things I wanted to touch on. Let me scroll back up here. There was something that caught my attention. Oh, yeah, that's it. Masks. I told you before that my wife and I had found, this was last week, maybe the week before, in a previous episode of the podcast, I mentioned that we had, our favorite masks were ones that we had bought from a place called Thompson Tees. It's a t-shirt company, and they're making masks. And that was up until yesterday. And I found the new favorite mask. And I know you're thinking, well, God, please don't tell us this. Here's the thing. I did not want to wear masks. I still don't like wearing masks. And so what I look for is the most comfortable mask I can find. That's what I look for. Because if I'm going to have to wear it, I want to be comfortable. I don't want to feel like I'm suffocating. I don't want to be heat stroked. I want it to be as breathable and comfortable as it possibly can be. Because, and here's the big thing, they're checking you for your masks, but they're not checking what kind of mask you have. Now, if you want to go buy N95 rated masks, knock your little self out. Buy them to your heart's content. I bought a couple of them. They were ridiculously expensive. Why? Because there are predators out there taking advantage of fear. And they're also so incredibly uncomfortable to wear because you feel like you're suffocating. They're not meant to be worn if you're hoofing it around. So if you're on a mission at Home Depot or Lowe's, you're going to get something and you're trotting it off back to the section where you know your stuff is, it won't be long before you feel like I'm suffocating. And so that's how I am. I opt for a mask I can actually breathe in. And that doesn't feel like it's smashing my nose flat and et cetera, et cetera. I want some comfort. I want to be able to breathe because honestly, I'm not buying all the hype, but I can't grocery shop and I can't go a lot of other places unless I'm wearing a mask. Walmart is not happy about you coming in without one. There are other places. I went to a Harbor Freight Tools a few weeks ago and they turned me away because I didn't have a mask on. And since then, I keep one in the console of my vehicle because I don't wear it while I'm driving, but doggone it, if I'm getting out and going someplace, I look around and see the signs. The signs are on the doors. You recognize them now. They all look pretty much the same, right? You from the parking lot, you can see as you pass by the entrance. Yeah, they're going to make me wear a mask. So, and the laws are out there. Plus, you've also got all the Karens out there who are going to jump your case if you're not wearing a mask. So, to minimize the idiocy, you wear a mask. Well, I got to tell you, I found some masks that I think are going to be the winners now. And those are from Vera Bradley. Yes, the designer, Vera Bradley. Go to their website. Go to the Vera Bradley website. They have masks. They're $8 a piece. That's a little pricey, I know, if you've been buying the disposables. But these are comfortable. They're large. They don't restrict you. They feel good on the face. They've built with enough room in front that you don't feel like you're suffocating. So far, they're great. Plus, if you really are concerned, they have a space for a filter in the front, so you can add more material. Just giving you a little heads up. The Vera Bradley masks. Those are the new favorites around our place. All right. So, let's see. Where are we going right now? Okay, first up, the convention last night. young man, Nick Sandman. Nick Sandman spoke at the convention. They tried to cancel him for simply standing still with a MAGA hat on. You remember the story. He and his high school group had been to the Capitol. He had stopped at a vendor's stand and bought a MAGA hat. And the next thing he knew, he was being accosted. And he just smiled and stood there. And the news media made all kinds of baseless accusations about what actually happened. And people, the leftists on social media, were cruel, unkind, evil, vile. And then he and his family hired an attorney and began suing the media outlets that lied about him. And he began winning, which is one of the sweet things about this story, is that he sued CNN for $250 million, $250 million, and he won. There was a settlement, so he's not getting that much, and the amount has not been disclosed. But even if it was, a paltry $25 million, Nick Sandman is set for life. And his kids and his grandchildren are set for life. He won, and he's still suing more outlets. We'll see what happens with him. But last night, Nick Sandman spoke at the RNC convention.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Nick Sandman, and I'm the teenager who was defamed by the media after an encounter with a group of protesters on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial last year. Before I begin, I'd like to thank President Trump for the opportunity to share some of my story and why it matters so much to this November's election. In 2019, I attended the March for Life in Washington, D.C., where I demonstrated in defense of the unborn. Later that day, I bought a Make America Great Again hat because our president, Donald Trump, has distinguished himself as one of the most pro-life presidents in the history of our country, and I wanted to express my support for him too. Looking back now, how could I possibly imagine that the simple act of putting on that red hat would unleash hate from the left and make myself the target of network and cable news networks nationwide? Being from Kentucky, the birthplace of Abraham Lincoln, my classmates and I visited the Lincoln Memorial. I found myself face to face with Nathan Phillips and other professional protesters looking to turn me into the latest poster child showing why Trump is bad. While the media portrayed me as an aggressor with a relentless smirk on my face, in reality, the video confirms I was standing with my hands behind my back and an awkward smile on my face that hid two thoughts. One, don't do anything that might further agitate the man banging a drum in my face. And two, I was trying to follow a family friend's advice, never to do anything to embarrass your family, your school, or your community. Before I knew what was happening, it was over. One of Mr. Phillips' fellow agitators yelled out, "We got him. It's all right here on video. And we won, Grandpa." What I thought was a strange encounter quickly developed into a major news story, complete with video footage. My life changed forever in that one moment. The full war machine of the mainstream media revved up into attack mode. They did so without researching the full video of the incident, without ever investigating Mr. Phillips' motives, or without ever asking me for my side of the story. And do you know why? Because the truth was not important. Advancing their anti-Christian, anti-conservative, anti-Donald Trump narrative was all that mattered. And if advancing their narrative ruined the reputation and future of a teenager from Covington, Kentucky, well, so be it. That would teach him not to wear a MAGA hat. I learned what was happening to me had a name. It was called being canceled, as in annulled, as in revoked, as in made void. Canceled is what's happening to people around this country who refuse to be silenced by the far left. Many are being fired, humiliated, or even threatened. And often, the media is a willing participant. But I would not be canceled. I fought back hard to expose the media for what they did to me, and I won a personal victory. While much more must be done, I look forward to the day that the media returns to providing balanced, responsible, and accountable news coverage. I know President Trump hopes for that too. And I know you'll agree with me when we say that no one in this country has been a victim of unfair media coverage more than President Donald Trump. In November, I believe this country must unite around a president who calls the media out and refuses to allow them to create a narrative instead of reporting the facts. I believe we must join a president who will challenge the media to return to objective journalism. And together, I believe we must all embrace our First Amendment rights and not hide in fear of the media or from the tech companies or from the outraged mob either. This is worth fighting for. This is worth voting for. And this is what Donald Trump stands for. Thank you all for listening to me tonight. And one more thing. Let's make America great again.
And he puts on the hat at the end. Nice touch. Next Stanman from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial last night on the Republican National Convention. He had great things to say. And he revealed the truth behind that, what actually happened to him that day. You should remember. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective Podcast for this Wednesday, the 26th day of August 2020. Mark Congleton here, driving the big bus through Crazyville. We're looking at things that happened last night on the convention. Let's see. I think I'm going to shift gears and go a different direction because I want to, Yeah, we can do that. That's the convention itself is revealing something, and I think it's important to note this. And that is that there is a remarkable difference between Democrats and not Republicans, but conservative people. Because the Republicans, we use the term rhino, Republican in name only. The Republicans long ago decided that it wasn't worth fighting. It was worth going along just to be able to stay on the job. And that's what this article by Robert Spencer from PJ Media is about. It's called "The Republican Convention is Proof the Party of Bush, McCain, and Romney is Dead." And here's what he has to say. The Democratic Party propaganda machine, more commonly known as the mainstream media, has been gushing over the establishment Republicans who appeared at the Democratic National Convention to denounce President Trump and endorse Joe Biden. But as last night's Republican National Convention showed, the days of the Republican Party being a pale shadow of the Democrats are over. In 2020, as in 2016, but not for a considerable period of time before that, we actually have a choice, not an echo, as Barry Goldwater offered America way back in 1964. As rating America's presidents, an America first look at who is best, who is overrated, and who was an absolute disaster demonstrates, the United States has been under the control of what is essentially a one-party system in two factions since at least the early 1950s. One of the most damaging aspects of the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower, the first Republican president since the onset of the Great Depression, was his refusal to challenge the basic premises of the New Deal. That's how we got into this fix. The Eisenhower administration was generally a period of great prosperity. However, after 20 years of New Deal expansion of the government, it was widely expected by observers from both parties that Eisenhower would at least attempt to fight the Leviathan and diminish the gargantuan and ever-growing federal government. Instead, he did little to halt the expansion of federal power. He resisted numerous measures that would have repealed or rolled back New Deal programs. He was determinedly bipartisan, going along with numerous Democratic initiatives, even when they involved the centralization that he warned against. In 1954, he stated his guiding philosophy, quote, I have just one purpose outside of the job of keeping this world in peace, and that is to build up a strong, progressive Republican Party in this country. If the right wing wants a fight, they're going to get it. If they want to leave the Republican Party and form a third party, that's their business. But before I end up, either this Republican Party will reflect progressivism, or I won't be with them anymore. George W. Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Paul Ryan couldn't have said it better. With the Republicans implementing large government programs and the Democrats remaining the standard bearers for an expanded federal government, voters had no choice but to accept it. Even Eisenhower realized this. In 1964, 3 years out of office and a popular and respected elder statesman, he wrote in an article for the Saturday Evening Post entitled, "Why I Am a Republican." In it, he declared, "I am increasingly disturbed by the steady, obvious drift of our nation toward a centralization of power for the federal government. And in this fact is found the primary reason why I sincerely urge all voters, no matter their present political affiliations, to take a fresh, thoughtful look at the basic Republican philosophy and Republican performance as compared to that of the Democrats. For the hard fact is that under many years of Democratic Party leadership, our country has been lured into the easy way, a path of federal expediency, which, like a narcotic, may give us a false sense of well-being, but in the long run is dangerous to our future, our basic rights, our moral fiber, and our individual freedom." That meant that both parties endorsed a rapidly expanding federal government, higher taxes, and more state interference in the daily lives of Americans. His 1964 article suggests that by then, he had seen the error of his ways. But by then, it was too late. Eisenhower's modern republicanism reduced the Republican Party to a faint echo of the Democrats. Democrats would formulate grand proposals that generally involved a massive expansion of government spending and control. And instead of challenging these proposals at their foundations and arguing against them on principle, Republicans would merely quibble that they could be implemented more cheaply and efficiently. Eisenhower ensured that even when Republicans were in the majority, they continued to have a minority mentality. The Democrats were setting the agenda for the country. There would be a pushback against this assumption within the Republican Party, but the dominant mainstream of Republicanism ever since Ike has been to say, "me too," to the Democrats rather than, "I object." Eisenhower didn't originate the idea of making the Republican Party a pale copy of the Democratic Party rather than a genuine principled opposition. FDR's opponents, Alf Landon, Wendell Willkie, and Thomas E. Dewey, would likely have done much the same thing, but they lost and he won, so Eisenhower must be credited as the primary architect of what is essentially a single party in two factions that has, for the most part, governed America since the 1950s. Rating America's presidents shows that while Ronald Reagan gave some pushback to this one-party rule, it has not been until the presidency of Donald J. Trump that it has been seriously challenged. The two-party system is back, or more precisely, the one-party system is facing off against one determined individual who is attracting an increasingly large following. This November will be decisive for the question of whether the one-party elites will, in the future, exert their hegemony unchallenged as they did for so long. I think he paints a very accurate picture here, Robert Spencer does, because we have fussed, you and I, for quite some time, that there is very little difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. And that is an accurate statement. There is, politically speaking, as far as the parties go, very little difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Both parties favor large government solutions to problems rather than putting the responsibility for problems back in the hands of the states and only stepping in when there is no other option. We've been watching this happen for quite some time, and sadly, it just continues. It's up to you and I to realize the fact that Donald Trump is not playing footsie with the Republicans, and they don't like it. And many of them have left and decided to form their own little anti-Trump groups because they liked playing the game along with the Democrats. And that's one of the reasons they won't stand up against things, the horror things like the horror of abortion. One of last night's speakers had a little something to say about abortion. Her name is Abby Johnson.
My name is Abby Johnson, and I spent 8 years working for Planned Parenthood, but today I am a pro-life activist. When I was in college, Planned Parenthood approached me at a volunteer fair. They talked about helping women in crisis and their commitment to keep abortion safe, legal, and rare. I was convinced to volunteer and later offered a full-time job as a medical assistant before my promotion to director of the clinic. I truly believed I was helping women, but things drastically changed in 2009. In April, I was awarded Planned Parenthood's Employee of the Year Award and invited to their annual gala where they present the Margaret Sanger Award, named for their founder. And Margaret Sanger was a racist who believed in eugenics. Her goal when founding Planned Parenthood was to eradicate the minority population. Today, almost 80% of Planned Parenthood abortion facilities are strategically located in minority neighborhoods. And every year, Planned Parenthood celebrates its racist roots by presenting the Margaret Sanger Award. Later in August, my supervisor assigned me a new quota to meet, an abortion quota. I was expected to sell double the abortions performed the previous year. When I pushed back, underscoring Planned Parenthood's public-facing goal of decreasing abortions, I was reprimanded and told, "Abortion is how we make our money." But the tipping point came a month later when a physician asked me to assist with an ultrasound-guided abortion. Nothing prepared me for what I saw on the screen. An unborn baby fighting back, desperate to move away from the suction. And I'll never forget what the doctor said next. "Beam me up, Scotty." The last thing I saw was a spine twirling around in the mother's womb before succumbing to the force of the suction. On October 6th, I left the clinic, looking back only to remember why I now advocate so passionately for life. I founded and currently run And Then There Were None, a nonprofit organization that's helped nearly 600 abortion workers transition out of the industry. For most people who consider themselves pro-life, abortion is abstract. They can't even conceive of the barbarity. They don't know about the products of conception room and abortion clinics, where infant corpses are pieced back together to ensure nothing remains in the mother's wombs, or that we joked and called it the pieces of children room. You see, for me, abortion is real. I know what it sounds like. I know what abortion smells like. Did you know abortion even had a smell? I've been the perpetrator to these babies, to these women. And I now support President Trump because he has done more for the unborn than any other president. During his first month in office, he banned federal funds for global health groups that promote abortion. That same year, he overturned an Obama-Biden rule that allowed government subsidy of abortion. He appointed a record number of pro-life judges, including two Supreme Court justices. And importantly, he announced a new rule protecting the rights of healthcare workers objecting to abortion, many of whom I work with every day. Life is a core tenet of who we are as Americans. And this election is a choice between two radical anti-life activists and the most pro-life president we have ever had. That's something that should compel you to action. Go door to door, make calls, talk to your neighbors and friends, and vote on November 3rd, take action that reelects our president and do it with our very most vulnerable Americans in mind, the ones who haven't been born yet.
Welcome back to the Daily Perspective Podcast. How about Abby Johnson, huh? if you haven't seen it, you should search for and watch the movie Unplanned. That is Abby Johnson's story. And the thing is that she spoke for just under 5 minutes, and she told America more about abortion, the reality of abortion, than most know from the mainstream media, because they're also in the pocket of the abortion industry. Remember what she said. Abortion is how we make our money. This is what she was told by Planned Parenthood. And that's the fact, Jack, as they say.
That's the fact, Jack!
The First Lady also spoke last night. It's a telling measure of our mean-spirited culture that the First Lady of the United States has been mocked and vilified for daring to redesign the Rose Garden. What she did was she actually took it back to its former glory from back during the JFK years. And it's interesting that people talked about how, look at how much color there was in it before. Hello, it's August. They'll bloom again, just not right now. Well, whether the design is pleasing or not, it's clear that the media wouldn't be giving Melania Trump the Jill Biden treatment when she spoke to the Republican convention. She's been the least public First Lady in decades. English is not her native language. But the principal sin of this elegant former fashion model is that she's married to, well, him. In the run-up to Tuesday night's appearance, journalists kept bringing up her 2016 address, in which a mishap caused her staff to plagiarize some passages from an old Michelle Obama speech. If you're like me, you probably forgot about that. But they don't want you to. Before a small audience in the revamped garden, Melania Trump did what virtually no other speaker had. She acknowledged the impact of the coronavirus and expressed sympathy for its victims. She said, since March, our lives have changed drastically because of the invisible enemy. She offered sympathy and prayers for those who have lost a loved one or are suffering, and said, Donald will not rest until an effective treatment is found. That was no small thing at a convention that talked about the pandemic in the past tense, when it was talked about at all. It wasn't just cheerleading. And she declined to use her time to attack the other side. Not a natural orator, the First Lady said she was humbled by coming here from a communist country and living the American dream. Despite negative or false media headlines, she said the president won't lose focus on helping the country. She also talked about Africa, drug addiction, violence, and motherhood. It was, in short, a plain-spoken and compassionate talk. While some pundits on Twitter credited Melania with speaking frankly about the virus, others questioned what she sees in her husband, ridiculed her outfit, or laughed at her delivery. One called it a Seinfeld speech about nothing. I don't know if you saw Kathy Griffin's vile, vulgar response on Twitter. She's typical of the mindless leftists who lash out with the most vulgarity they can in order to make an impact. It was left to New York Times columnist David Brooks to scold. He said, stop scoffing. Melania's speech is at least relatively decent and humane. Even fierce Republican Trump critic Mike Murphy called it the only high ground presidential speech you'll ever hear at this convention. Her words even won over some TV pundits, from CNN's Dana Bash to MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. She said, that's the first time in 2 days we've had even a straightforward expression of sympathy. Rachel, this is all laid out and properly designed. Every speech has a purpose. Everything is in order, a certain order for a certain reason. Now it was time. And it was Melania they chose to deliver the words. There's more to this. If you want to read the rest of the article from Fox News, it's in the show notes. Please grab the show notes today at Daily Perspective Podcast.com and have a look. Finish the rest of it. The mainstream press was kind, but they've ignored her, except to ridicule her. largely, for the entire time the Trumps have been in the White House. They have embraced bizarre conspiracy theories about her. They've had negative things to say all along the way. But when faced with almost a half hour of her speaking to America, they couldn't deny some realities, if they're being honest. Sadly, most of them are not. And that's what we have to deal with in the mainstream press today. Because progressives don't like honesty. Honesty is vulnerable. And progressives, in spite of the fact that they talk about vulnerability and embrace it publicly, privately, they will not allow themselves to be vulnerable. Because to be vulnerable means that you're going to admit you're wrong. And they never, ever will. And I suspect that's the truth in the case of George Floyd. You remember George Floyd. It was his death while in custody of police officers that started the riots that are going on all over the country right now. Well, there have been some new filings in the case against the former Minneapolis police officers involved in the death of George Floyd. Those findings show that a medical examiner, says Floyd had enough fentanyl in his system that it really could have been lethal. The report from the Hennepin County Medical Examiner released yesterday, details his comments about the results of the toxicology test on Floyd. The report read, "That is a fatal level of fentanyl under normal circumstances." However, the report reiterated the medical examiner's opinion that there were a multitude of causes contributing to his death. According to KMSP-TV, the June 1st memo says Dr. Andrew Baker said that if Mr. Floyd had been found dead in his home or anywhere else, and there were no other contributing factors, he would conclude that it was an overdose death. This release was a part of the request from the attorneys representing Tao Thao, one of the former Minneapolis police officers facing charges in the death of 46-year-old Floyd. An independent autopsy of Floyd, ordered by his family, found that he died from asphyxiation from sustained pressure, and it reported evidence of neck and back compression that led to a lack of blood flow to the brain. That finding was released in June by an attorney for the family that also claimed that no other medical issue contributed to his death. Let's stop there. An independent autopsy, ordered by his family, released by an attorney for the family. The family hired an attorney. The attorney hired an examiner. What is the attorney's job here? The attorney's job is to condemn the police and to absolve George Floyd of any responsibility in his own death. That's the attorney's job. His job, representing this family, is to absolve George Floyd from any responsibility and to place all the blame on the police. That's what he is being paid to do. And so, the independent autopsy of George Floyd, of course, found that he died from asphyxiation from sustained pressure. But a medical examiner, not being paid by the Floyd family or an attorney representing the Floyd family, and not beholden to a paycheck from the Floyd family, found something completely different and reveals that had they found George Floyd dead somewhere else under other circumstances, he would have ruled it a drug overdose. And so, we see what's really going on in the case of George Floyd. George Floyd, as we've seen before, had four times the lethal amount of fentanyl in his system. He also had methamphetamines. He had other things in his system as well. He was a drug addict, and he was high. George Floyd killed himself by overdosing on drugs. The people around him were concerned about him. They said, yeah, he's on his own little trip here. the reason the police were called was because not that he had passed a fake 20, but because of the way he was behaving and he was behind the wheel of a car. George Floyd died of an overdose of fentanyl in the custody of police. Will that change the outcome for these officers? We can only hope it does. But considering that Keith Ellison is in charge of the law in that state, don't hold your breath. That's it. God bless. Have a good day. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the next edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.